Israel's Benjamin Netanyahu has a message for the Lebanese people.
Lebanon was once known for its tolerance, for its beauty. Today, it's a place of chaos, a place of war.
The second hurricane in 2 weeks hits Florida.
The biggest area of impact, which will have the highest level of water coming into the communities, is going to be south of the eye.
Election officials try to reassure a skeptical public.
Right now, our government, you got to question everything about it. I mean, I wish I could say differently, but that's not how America feels.
Today is Thursday, October 10th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish.
And I'm Alexis Strope. We begin with the conflict in Israel. U.S. President Joe Biden spoke with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Wednesday. White House Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre said the call was beneficial.
It was productive. It was direct. It lasted about 30 minutes. And this is on top of more than a dozen calls that the president and the prime minister have had since October 7th of last year.
Biden and Netanyahu discussed a potential Israeli retaliation for Iran's missile attack on Israel last week. This follows Netanyahu's blunt video message to the Lebanese people.
This is a message to the people of Lebanon. Do you remember when your country was called the Pearl of the Middle East? I do. So what happened to Lebanon? A gang of tyrants and terrorists destroyed it. That's what happened. Lebanon was once known for its tolerance, for its beauty. Today, it's a place of chaos, a place of war. Israel withdrew from Lebanon 25 years ago. But the country that actually conquered Lebanon is not Israel, it's Iran. Iran, which finances and arms Hezbollah to serve Iran's interests at Lebanon's expense. Hezbollah has turned Lebanon into a stockpile of ammunition and weapons and a forward Iranian military base.
Meanwhile, Syrian state media reported an Israeli attack in the central Homs province early Thursday. Israeli authorities rarely comment on individual strikes in Syria, but have repeatedly said they would not allow archenemy Iran to expand its presence there.
And now, in the southeastern United States, for the second time in as many weeks, a large and powerful hurricane is coming ashore in Florida. Reuters' Jillian Kitchener has the story.
Panic buying at gas stations gripped Florida as Hurricane Milton closed in on the Tampa Bay area on Wednesday.
We've never had one like this. I've been here for 38 years and never had one that forced us to do this.
Meanwhile, officials continued to sound the alarm.
It's looking like the storm of the century.
At a White House briefing, President Joe Biden urged Florida residents to follow local safety recommendations. He also warned against disinformation about the storm and accused his predecessor of lying about ongoing relief efforts after Hurricane Helene.
Former President Trump has led the onslaught of lies. Assertions have been made that property is being confiscated. That's simply not true. They're saying the money is needed for this crisis is being diverted to migrants. What a ridiculous thing to say. It's not true. Now the claims are getting even more bizarre. Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene, a congresswoman of Georgia, is now saying the federal government is literally controlling the weather. We're controlling the weather. It's beyond ridiculous. It's got to stop.
FEMA Administrator Deanne Criswell said the impact of the latest storm could be devastating.
Hurricane Milton is going to be a deadly and catastrophic storm. It will bring massive storm surge, high winds, and severe flooding as it moves across the state of Florida.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis said thousands of National Guardsmen have been deployed to assist in recovery efforts.
We have 500 tactical vehicles, including 180 high water vehicles, aerial, water, and ground National Guard search and rescue teams. This is the largest Florida National Guard search and rescue mobilization in the entire history of the state of Florida.
The National Hurricane Center said Milton was expected to maintain hurricane strength as it crossed the Florida Peninsula, posing storm surge danger on the state's Atlantic coast as well.
That's Reuters' Jillian Kitchener with that report. And for a look on the ground in Tampa, I spoke with Kathy Carter at WUSF Radio.
What's it like there? What's the mood in the city? Have most people left? Is there anybody still around?
Well, you know, Steve, it does seem that a large number of the folks that will be impacted really took heed to all of the warnings. We're hearing from emergency officials across the greater Tampa Bay region, which is a pretty large area, specifically on the barrier islands, that folks have taken up the orders to evacuate. It's one of the biggest evacuations in the state of Florida, the barrier islands that folks might know: Clearwater Beach, St. Petersburg Beach, Siesta Key in Sarasota. All of those barrier islands were hit just a couple of weeks ago with pretty extensive storm surge. So with Helene, the hurricane that happened just a couple of weeks ago. So people saw what Helene did, and knowing that Milton was going to be far worse, a lot of people this time around did leave.
What's it like? Is it raining there now? Is it windy? Is it dangerous in the city? I mean, you're obviously there. It can't be that bad.
Well, I'm in the city of Tampa, but I am north of Tampa, quite a bit inland, not near any major body of water in a concrete building where I work. But the city of Tampa Bay, downtown, that is going to be dangerous for people to be in and about right now. Of course, folks aren't supposed to be out right now. Hillsborough County, which is where the city of Tampa is located, just told residents that they can no longer take them to shelters. They were providing shuttles, but the winds are starting to pick up, so they cannot provide that emergency transportation anymore. We're starting to feel the impacts of tropical storm winds. If I look out a window right now, it's dark, it's raining, but you don't really see the trees moving that badly yet. We're just starting to feel the gusts right now, but this is supposed to pick up really, really fast. From this moment forward, conditions will deteriorate really, really quickly.
One of the most dangerous things about this storm and any other really is the storm surge, the swell of water coming off the Gulf.
That is the biggest concern is the storm surge. You know the wind, people think that's the thing, but it's really the water that is pushed in through the ocean and then gets into all the creeks and the lakes and the tributaries that feed all of Tampa Bay, which, if anybody has an image of Tampa Bay, it is water, water, water. So with the storm surge, the biggest area of impact, which will have the highest level of water coming into the communities, is going to be south of the eye. So yesterday, that eye was going to hit the city of Tampa pretty directly, which would have been catastrophic. Well, right now, the eye has moved south. It's a little less than south of Sarasota County right now. So that means Sarasota County would feel the biggest impacts of the storm surge. Places like I mentioned before, Siesta Key, but then down to Charlotte County, which includes Punta Gorda and then Fort Myers. But the problem with saying that at this moment that I'm telling you, we still have time for this track to wobble. So the whole Gulf Coast from pretty much Cedar Key to Fort Myers could see anywhere from 10 to 15 feet of storm surge, depending on where this eye wall hits. North of the eye wall, less surge. South of the eye wall, more surge.
Kathy Carter of WUSF Radio in Tampa. Kathy, thanks for your time. Thanks for taking the time on what is no doubt a very busy day.
Okay. Happy to do it, Steve. Thank you.
So as the west coast of Florida prepares for its second massive hurricane in 2 weeks, it begs the question, is this normal? The short answer is no, it's not normal. But of course, it's more complicated than that. To help us sort it out, Steve spoke with Christina Dahl from the Union of Concerned Scientists.
First, there was Hurricane Helene. Now there's Hurricane Milton. How unusual is it for two very powerful, very destructive hurricanes to strike the same area in such a short period of time?
Yeah, this back-to-back nature of these two hurricanes is unusual, especially two storms of this magnitude. We know that the Gulf Coast of the United States is prone to hurricanes, and there are some places like the coast of Louisiana that have seen repeat storms happening each year. But to just be 2 weeks apart and for both of these storms to have such a high magnitude is really unusual.
What's behind this greater frequency of storms?
Yeah, so I would say it's not so much the increase in frequency of these storms, but it's an increase in the likelihood of storms reaching these higher categories, categories 3, 4, and 5. You know, the jury is still out as to whether climate change will increase the frequency of hurricanes, But it's pretty settled science at this point that climate change is increasing the frequency of strongest hurricanes. And so, you know, you can imagine this have happening. This might have happened in the past, but the storms would not have reached these higher categories that they're more likely to reach now in our warmer world.
Interesting. So the scientific consensus is that climate change is making the storms more powerful, making them larger, but not necessarily more frequent. So in an atmosphere absent of the climate change, Florida could still be getting hit by a second storm in 2 weeks. It just wouldn't be as bad.
That's right. And that's, you know, a generalization, because there are some real challenges to understanding how hurricanes are changing with climate change. And part of it is that when we look decades in the past, we didn't necessarily have the same quality of records of hurricanes as we have now. And there's a lot of natural variability from year to year in the number of hurricanes and the strength of hurricanes that we experience. So there's some challenges in trying to figure out exactly how hurricanes are changing and what might have happened, you know, in a different year in the past. But it's pretty safe to say that every aspect of the hurricanes that Florida and the Carolinas have experienced over the last couple of weeks, every aspect of them is being affected by climate change, from their strength to their rapid intensification to the amount of moisture they're bringing to the storm surge, et cetera.
So to the average person listening who is not a climate scientist, what does climate change do to a hurricane that makes it worse? Why is this so bad? How is this so bad?
Climate change affects hurricanes in a few different ways. First, climate change is causing our sea level to be higher. And as a result of that, that makes the storm surge from hurricanes deeper, and it can reach farther inland. Climate change is also adding fuel to hurricanes. We're warming our oceans, and that heat provides fuel and strength to a hurricane. And so we're seeing hurricanes become stronger than they were in the past. And then finally, we're seeing hurricanes carry more moisture. And again, that has to do with having a warmer ocean. So warmer ocean waters are easier to evaporate because heat allows for evaporation. That evaporation of ocean water goes into the hurricane, and the hurricane then carries that along and dumps it as rainfall along its path. So we're seeing deeper storm surge from hurricanes, we're seeing stronger hurricanes, stronger winds, and we're seeing hurricanes carry more moisture that then falls as rain.
Christina Dahl with the Union of Concerned Scientists. Dr. Dahl, thanks very much for your time. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thanks for having me on.
That's Steve speaking with Christina Dahl of the Union of Concerned Scientists.
And just as the United States grapples with two major hurricanes back to back, there's a different kind of storm brewing. This one, however, comes from the sun. AP correspondent Ed Donahue has that story.
A severe solar storm over the next few days could put even more stress on the nation's power grid. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration issued a severe geomagnetic storm watch. An outburst was detected from the sun. Louis Lanzarotti with the New Jersey Institute of Technology told the AP in 2010, the sun is a very fascinating star.
The sunspots are caused by magnetic field configurations on the sun, which can cause disturbances on the sun, which then propagate out to Earth.
Forecasters do not expect the latest solar storm to surpass the one that slammed Earth in May, the strongest in more than two decades. Power and radio signals could be disrupted. Richard Fisher with NASA says be ready just in case.
A little extra water and a good flashlight and a transistor radio are pretty good things to have.
I'm Ed Donahue.
Here are some of the other stories we're following from around the world. A new book by famed journalist Bob Woodward claims that former President Donald Trump may have had as many as 7 private phone calls with Russian President Vladimir Putin since leaving the White House. The claim raises eyebrows in light of Trump's repeated criticism of U.S. aid to Ukraine. Both the Trump campaign and the Kremlin denied the calls.
Saudi Arabia was defeated for a seat in the UN's premier human rights body Wednesday after a campaign by rights groups urging the world body's members to reject its bid. The 193-member General Assembly elected 18 new members Wednesday to serve on the 47-nation Human Rights Council.
A Claude Monet pastel that was looted by the Nazis has been returned to the descendants of the man who owned it when it was seized in Austria decades ago. The pastel had been sold off to support the Third Reich, and the family got the artwork back on Wednesday at the FBI field office in New Orleans.
VOA's International Edition continues. Along with Steve Karish, I'm Alexis Strobe. There's a lot of talk about electoral politics on this show and others, but just as important as the issues that motivate people to vote are the mechanics of the voting system itself. Former U.S. President Donald Trump and many of his supporters claim without evidence that the 2020 election was stolen, and they warn that the same could happen in 2024. Democratic and Republican election officials in Michigan dispute those claims and are working to assure Americans that their votes are secure and that the system will work. White House bureau chief Patsy Wittakusara brings us this story from Michigan.
This was the scene in Detroit, Michigan on Election Day 2020. Supporters of Donald Trump, fueled by his baseless claims of election fraud, pressured officials to stop counting votes. Many Trump supporters in Michigan are worrying about fraud in the upcoming election.
Right now, our government, you got to question everything about it. I mean, I wish I could say differently, but that's not how America feels. We don't trust nobody.
One case is enough to question the whole system.
Allegations that the 2020 election was rigged have been repeatedly debunked in U.S. courts. But disinformation around election integrity has gained traction among Republicans. Polls show they are more likely to trust Trump over government-certified election results. Officials in battleground states are working to assure voters that the election process is secure. They say disinformation can be dangerous. Jonathan Brader, director of the Michigan Bureau of Elections.
They can, in some cases, lead to people making threats to election officials or worse. But even if it doesn't result in any sort of physical violence, it does undermine trust long-term in the election system, which is bad for our republic and is bad for our democracy.
In many states, Republicans support efforts to assure voters that elections are secure, including Justin Roebuck, a Republican election official in Ottawa County, Michigan. He says it's an uphill battle.
Our political leaders at every level need to also seek facts and to seek data. And I think until that happens, we will have a problem, you know, in terms of our confidence and trust in the process.
In Michigan, Trump loyalists have already sued Secretary of State Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat, over absentee ballot processing guidelines and the voter registration list. Michigan Republican Party Chairperson Pete Hoekstra.
If Jocelyn Benson is not responding to what is required under the law, we will take her to court to get the courts to compel her to do that.
Benson dismissed it as a Republican campaign strategy.
In general, we see lawsuits masquerading as a legal strategy when they're really a PR strategy to get misinformation or sow seeds of doubt about our elections into the narrative.
Republicans and Democrats have launched election-related lawsuits in various battleground states, which could mean chaos in the November election. Kim Wyman, senior fellow with Bipartisan Policy Center's Elections Project via Zoom.
Any kind of legal challenge happening this close to an election typically is lawyers putting a placeholder in case they may not win in a state or may not have an outcome they like. And it gives them the ability to challenge the election after the fact.
There are other potential disruptions, including efforts by county officials who support Trump to delay election certification. Patsy Wittakusara, VOA News, Flint, Michigan.
Turning now to the war in Ukraine. As we reported on Wednesday's show, President Joe Biden had to cancel his trip to Germany so that he could stay in Washington to oversee hurricane relief efforts. This means that the Ukraine Defense Contact Group meeting he was scheduled to attend at the Ramstein Air Base in Germany was postponed. That's Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky, who says he understands a new schedule will be made for the meeting to discuss his so-called victory plan.
Sudan's brutal civil war is another ongoing conflict we're keeping tabs on. The leader of the Sudanese paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, known as Hemeti, accused Egypt of being involved in airstrikes on the group's troops in a recorded speech on Wednesday. He also accused Cairo of training and providing drones to the country's army, which has greatly gained an upper hand in the conflict that has ravaged the country for almost 18 months. His accusations were not just targeted at Egypt. Hemeti said Egypt used U.S. bombs in its strikes. If the Americans were not in agreement, these bombs would not reach Sudan, he added. He also said Tigrayan, Eritrean, Azerbaijani, and Ukrainian mercenaries were present in the country and reiterated accusations that Iranians participated in the war alongside the army. The Egyptian Foreign Ministry denied the accusations.
Elsewhere in Africa, Kenya's National Assembly has voted to impeach the country's deputy president over accusations of corruption and abuse of office. His fate now rests in the hands of the Senate. Scott Walterman narrates this report by Mohamed Youssef in Nairobi.
The process to consider removal of Kenya's deputy president from office moved to the Senate Wednesday after Parliament approved a motion to do so Tuesday night. Ahead of the vote, embattled Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua and his allies presented his defense to the National Assembly for more than 90 minutes. But the lawmakers were not swayed, and 281 of them approved a motion to remove Gachagua from office. 44 others voted against the motion, and one abstained. Gachagua was accused of acquiring properties through corrupt means, though he argues the assets belong to his late brother. He's also accused of practicing ethnic politics and acting to undermine the government. The impeachment comes after Gachagua fell out with President William Ruto. The deputy president has denied all of the allegations against him, calling them outrageous and saying they are propaganda meant to tarnish his name. Political commentator Martin Ndadi says the way in which Gachagua works with other politicians and the people cost him his job.
His fate is sealed. You know, he antagonized the MPs, he antagonized the Senate by talking badly about the chambers and the speakers. And generally, he's not a pro-people-bus person. He has very poor people management skills.
Some members of parliament, like Robert Mbui, who is also deputy leader of the minority, were against the impeachment. He said the House should concentrate on public issues instead of debating one man.
The cost of living has gone too high. People have no jobs. Mr. Speaker, those are the things that this House should passionately deal with. But Mr. Speaker, for a whole day, and from, you know, I don't know, even the last week or 2 weeks, to deal with that one matter, Mr. Speaker, I think that we are losing direction. And it is important, Mr. Speaker, that we deal with the things that are affecting our people.
In the past 4 months, Kenya has witnessed a wave of protests aimed at President Ruto's government over allegations of corruption by some politicians and government officers. Kenyans also protested high taxes and Parliament's alleged failure to act independently from the president. Some politicians have accused the deputy president of helping to organize anti-government protests, an accusation that Gachagua denies. Kenyan political expert Harmon Manyora says the parliament is setting a dangerous precedent that threatens the country's political future and ethnic cohesion.
It shouldn't surprise us that in the future we can have governments falling in the manner in which governments come and go in parliamentary democracies like India, you know, Israel, UK, Italy, which I doubt we can withstand. From a political front, also, this is a country with a lot of flashpoints. It is an ethnically charged country, and a move like this has the potential of negatively impacting the country by way of division. And you can never know where it can lead us.
The debate and voting about Gachagua's conduct will continue next week, and after that, some believe the issue may go to court, where he could seek legal help to either keep his job or clear his name of the allegations against him. For Mohamed Youssef in Nairobi, I'm Scott Walterman.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strove.
And I'm Steve Karish. Thanks for listening.